Senator, let's get started with the situation with Scott Ritter. FBI has raided his house in order to find some sort of evidence against him. What's your understanding on this case?
Well, now I don't know all of the details of it, but I know that Scott Ritter has been a very, very effective and vocal advocate of peace in particularly in Ukraine, but also in Gaza, and he's very knowledgeable. He's been involved in negotiation. He was an inspector who was involved in inspecting the arms in Iraq before we ever went and attacked Iraq. And I think he became unpopular with the CIA and government agencies because he came to the conclusion that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which turned out to be absolutely true. We ended up killing a couple of million Iraqis without any cause whatsoever. We invaded the country, we destroyed it. It never has come back to what it was under Saddam Hussein. And so he is very unpopular for that. And he has continued. He has a tremendous amount of insight in foreign affairs in these various hot spots. And I think he is such an effective voice I think he began to be perceived as problematic for the deep state. And it's not unusual. You know, the FBI is, they are used to target various individuals that the foreign policy establishment finds inconvenient. I can't tell you what the background is on that, but I know that during a flight back from, forget whether he was going to Moscow or back, but I think they took his passport and those kind of things. So they sort of had their eye on him. I suspect that this is designed to silence a very effective vocal advocate of peace in Ukraine. So we'll see where it goes, but we've seen with the election of Donald Trump back in 2016, the FBI conducted a very orchestrated campaign of disinformation and actual forgery and fraud in order to obtain a wiretap authorization to tap the Republican candidates and committee, and in the end it turned out that in fact this was all contrived. They gave some minor slap on the hand to the guy who was convicted, the FBI agent who was convicted of forgery. Had he been a Republican, he'd have probably been in prison for 20, 30 years. But that's the way that it works. Washington is unfortunate. You know, we have an honest people, but Washington is dramatically corrupt. And it's kind of a strange anomaly because often you'll have a country whose people tend to be corrupt and whose government reflects the type of people. The United States is a little bit different because the American people tend to be pretty honest, pretty decent people. But at the very highest levels, the government is very deeply corrupt, and that's just the way that it is. I think Scott Ritter is probably just a victim of the system that has worked for for generations. Since I was a kid, they've been doing this kind of thing. They were very deeply involved in the block that overthrew Nixon, because of this Watergate thing. The courts are still corrupt in Washington, D.C. The judge who oversaw the Watergate cases that led to the resignation of President Nixon, the judge in that case was meeting with the prosecutors and plotting out how they should present their case to him in court. And there were a dozen or 20 meetings, a lot of meetings, where he met with the prosecutors in private and instructed them what he wanted them to do and how he wanted them to present the case so that he could develop it the way he wanted. So this is the kind of corruption. I mean, this is really major corruption. This is not minor corruption. The American people, at least an element of them, the intelligentsia, are beginning to grasp the fact that this is the way Washington is. So we'll see what happens to Scott. I don't think they're likely to find anything criminal. I understand there's a rumor that they're trying to say that he was not a registered foreign agent. This, the idea of having somebody designated as a foreign agent, Washington is swarming with people who represent foreign governments for money. I mean, there are probably, it's probably 10,000 or more, maybe there are tens of thousands who are doing this without being registered foreign agent. But the way that it works is the Treasury Department will designate somebody who is politically inconvenient, and they put them under the gun. They selectively prosecute. They go after them, and it's a mechanism designed to silence people who are out doing something wrong, but people who are exercising their First Amendment right to free speech, and who simply disclose the truth. And when it comes to foreign policy, it is an ugly ball of sausage that they're making in D.C., and it's very awkward when the facts are presented the way that Scott Ritter has done.
Yeah. And when it comes to the conflict in Ukraine right now, Ukrainians have attacked the Kursk region, and in the West, when you look at what Lindsey Graham is talking about, he's calling it brilliant, beautiful, with all these fantasy terms that he has in his mind. And Zelensky, when he's calling, this is Putin's end. And how do you see this attack of Ukrainians on this region, and is there anything good coming out of this attack for Ukrainians?
Well, it's very interesting what's happening in Kursk. This is an area towards the north and along the border between Ukraine and Russia. It's actually the site of one of the great battles of all time. It was they had the biggest tank battle in history between the German army and the Soviet army. I believe there were 2,000 tanks involved in the single battle. It was just enormous. This is nothing nearly that big, but it's very interesting. What happened? The Ukrainian army is stretched thin, and they have been carrying on a pretty effective defense, but they have been losing ground steadily to the Russians. The Russians are just just attacking over and over, and they're moving towards Petrovsk, which is an important area that is sort of a linchpin to the defenses of the Russians down in the Donbass area. And so what happened, the Russians looked at this and they said, okay, well, we're advancing, but we would like to draw off some of the Ukrainian forces that are defending against us. So they launched an attack in an area that was not well defended by the Ukrainian army. It was at Kharkiv. And they had some dramatic success. Now, the purpose of that attack was not to take over Kharkiv, which is the second biggest city in Ukraine. The purpose was to draw soldiers from the battle for Petrovsk and to move them up to the north. The Russians did this very successfully. They threatened to drive forces towards Kharkiv, and Zelensky had to defend Kharkiv because, you know, it's the second biggest city in Ukraine. And so he knew, I think the Ukrainians knew what the Russians were doing, but politically, they had to shift forces up there, and they did it. And it was very helpful to the Russians. Now, the Ukrainians looked at what had happened, and they said, okay, well, they were able to draw us by attacking in an unexpected place up in the north. Maybe we could do the same thing. And so they picked out Kursk as the place they were going to do it. And they did, they had to pull troops to bring them up to the north. And of course it made their very thinly stretched lines even thinner, but they felt like it was worth doing. There is uncertainty about how much involvement the US and NATO had in this action. The US and NATO say they were totally taken by surprise. I can't tell you, honestly, I can't say for certain, but I know that the US and NATO provided a tremendous amount of assistance to this operation. And so the Ukrainians were able to assemble about 12,000 troops in some degree of secrecy. And then they attacked across the Russian border. Now, the Russian border was pretty much undefended up in this area. Strategically, it's not an important area. And so they were able to attack. And all that was defending the area was some local policemen, a few border guards, but it was more or less an undefended area. So the initial attack involved about 1,000 combat troops. Now, I told you they assembled 12,000 troops, but when you have 12,000 military, 12,000 soldiers, that doesn't mean you have 12,000 fighters. You have to have people to run hospitals, to run the ammunition depots, to repair vehicles, all kinds of logistics. So I think the estimate is that when you're talking about actual fighters, it may be about 20% of the total force who are fighters. So that gives them, you know, a couple of thousand, 2,500 people to work with, maybe as high as 3,000, but it's a relatively small number of people. So they burst across the border. They went about 7 miles deep into Russia on a front that stretches about 12 miles. So they've taken something like 400 square miles of Russian territory. Now, this does create a political problem for Moscow, because you can't just ignore the fact that you've got troops pouring across your border. Your people say, hey, what are you doing? You've got to stop. And the Ukrainians are, you know, they've been given orders. If somebody comes out into the open, if a civilian comes out of a house or whatever, you're to gun them down, just shoot them and kill them. Or run them over if you've got a vehicle. And so there have been a number of civilians who were killed. And then a number of these police and border guards have been captured without too much of a fight, because all of a sudden you have 1,000 troops come across the border. These are hardened, heavily armed troops. And, you know, if you're a police chief and you've got a dozen policemen, what do? You say, okay, we surrender. I would do that, you know, and I've been prepared to fight to the death many times, but, you know, you don't do ridiculous things. So the Ukrainians have captured some police and some soldiers. And gradually the Russians are beginning to bring people in. Now, the key to this whole thing is Ukraine will achieve something of significance if they can force Russia to draw troops away from essential battles into this other one, which is more of a showpiece action. And I know that ABC News reported last night that even though they had captured this 400 square miles, that the battle for Petrovsk, it said that in the last week, Russia has doubled the number of assaults from somewhere in the 20s up to 52 in a day. So Russia, instead of drawing critical troops from that vital battle, they've actually doubled down. And I think what happened is the Russian high command, they understood exactly what the Ukrainians were doing and why they were doing. They weren't doing it so they could capture Russia. They were doing it so that they could embarrass the government and force it to shift troops to the north. That's what they hoped to do. It was a reasonable thing for Ukraine to do. But what we see so far is that the Russians have been very disciplined in their response. They have not drawn away troops from the critical battle. Now, they have announced that they've shifted some from other areas that are not the hot spots in the war. So they have shifted some people. And I would not be surprised if it takes a month or 6 weeks for Russia to gradually push all of these people back, because it takes some time to get Russian reinforcements up there. Here's the thing. If you've got, let's say you have 1,000 or you have 3,000 troops, and they have occupied 400 square miles, well, you do the math. I mean, if it's 1,000, you know, you got a couple guys per square mile. So what do you do with a couple of guys per square mile? That's nothing. You can't effectively defend it. So let's say that Zelensky ordered them drive on, and let's say they were able to take over 1,000 square miles. Well, what did that mean? One man per square mile. What do you do with that? You know, a group of angry school children could beat up and kill the one man per square mile. So they very rapidly have reached what's called the culmination point. When an attack is launched, it loses strength as it goes along, unless you're able to reinforce very quickly. And it reinforces because its lines of support become extended. In other words, when the Ukrainian soldiers across the border in Ukraine, when they're shipping ammunition and supplies and things, now they've got miles to go instead of, you know, a couple kilometers. Now they're going, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 miles. And so it becomes very difficult. They become attenuated and the force is losing its oomph. It's losing its punch because it's spread out now. So I think we've reached the culmination point, which is the maximum point. And when your force reaches that culmination point, it becomes very vulnerable because it's stretched, it's thinly distributed, and now, you know, the Russians will come in with whatever force they can muster. That Ukrainian force is not going to last very long. It's going to fade. So in my mind, the outcome of the battle has been decided. And it was decided when the Russians made that calculation that we're going to continue focusing on Petrovsk. We're going to continue that battle. We're going to double down on it. Maybe we'll move some more troops into that battle because now we know that they've stretched themselves even thinner. So I think that it was not an unreasonable thing to do. For the Ukrainians, they're under a lot of pressure from Washington to keep this war going until Election Day. And the American election is on the 5th of November. They must not end the war before the 5th of November, or Kamala Harris, who's taken over for Biden, Kamala Harris would lose. And they can't afford that. They've got to win this election, whether the Ukrainian war ends up being won by Russia or who. It's got to go on. So I think that was probably the biggest part of this calculation is what can we do to create the illusion that Ukraine is still in the game. It's still a formidable fighting force. Well, we can do it by attacking an area where there are no enemy troops and seizing it. And in the media, it looks like, hey, look, we've captured 400 square miles of nothing. And so it made sense to do it. It was kind of a payoff to the U.S. and to NATO to keep this thing going. But in very practical terms, I think it was a defeat for Ukraine because they have not managed to draw away the Russian army.
When you look at the U.S. Defense Department spokesman, Patrick Ryder, he's talking about that they don't know the purpose behind this attack on the part of Ukrainians. When he talks this way, in your opinion, he's talking to the domestic audience or is he trying to send a message to Russia? Because that doesn't make sense for Russians.
You know, I can't tell you for certain how directly involved the U.S. and NATO are in this because they have a lot of motivation to say, hey, this is all a Ukrainian deal, because it is a very, very risky endeavor. And it's not likely to turn out well for Ukraine in any event. I mean, these soldiers are tremendously at risk. And there's even some possibility, if the Russians decided to do it, there is a fairly significant city that's across the Ukrainian border from Kursk, where this battle is taking place. And the Russians, if they wanted to, and they may not want to devote troops to this, but if they wanted to, once they accumulate some forces, they could first drive out the Ukrainians, drive them across the border, and then just not stop and just continue and capture the city of Sumy. I don't think they will. Well, I can't tell you what they'll do, honestly. I can't tell you, but there's a risk. Now, why would the Pentagon say this was just a total mystery to them, total surprise? NATO is saying the same thing. There really are two reasons. Number one, it could be that it's true. Number two, it could be that it is so risky and so likely to end up as a debacle that they just want to say, okay, we don't want anybody thinking that this had anything to do with the Biden-Harris administration, and don't blame us if somebody needs to take the blame. How about Zelensky? We don't mind seeing him get bounced out of office if necessary. So it's one of these things. Nations do this type of thing. And the CIA is very good at it. British MI6 is masterful at creating sort of these false flag situations where an attack occurs and we don't know anything about this. This is just something that's happening. It's you know, we see something similar going on in some of these African countries. In Niger, the United States was just forced to leave Niger. There are several of the countries, the former French colonies, that have just gotten so fed up with the way they're being treated by the old French colonial empire. Now it's not an overt empire, it's sort of a subtle empire. But they started to kick the French out, and now it kicked the Americans out. So there was an ambush recently, and it killed a bunch of the Nigerian troops and a bunch of the Wagner mercenaries who are Russians. Prigozhin, who was the leader of the Wagner group, which was so prominent early in the war, very, very effective, very deadly force for the Russians. And Prigozhin, in the end, he went nutso and he decided to drive towards Moscow. And I think he was hoping that he had become popular enough to where people would rise up and he could conquer the government in Moscow. And nobody joined him, and after a while, he fled the country, and then later he was assassinated. But anyway, Prigozhin, he sort of cut his teeth on setting up this whole network in Africa with the Wagner group, which were mercenaries, very highly trained, highly paid professional soldiers. So now if the Wagner group still exists, it's not called that, but Russia, it's now under the control of the Russian government. And so they had people who were helping, these were mercenaries, and they were helping the government of Niger to fight against sort of a group like ISIS. It's the African equivalent, very, very radical, violent terror group. And anyway, this group, it was a significant group, and they were out and they were attacked, surprise attacked by this group of Islamic militants in the world. And then Ukraine started crowing about, well, look, you know, look what we were able to do. We were able to defeat the Wagner group. And of course, the reason that they occurred was that the United States, which has just been booted out of Niger, was very likely providing the intelligence through CIA channels to Ukraine. And then Ukraine used that, and they had people that they sent in, and they helped to establish the attack. But you can see, you know, we have a long history. The United States is, you know, we launched this war on terror, but the fact is that going way back to the time of the Soviet Union, the United States organized a vast terror army in Afghanistan. It was under the direction of the Central Intelligence Agency. At one point, we had 300,000 terrorists who had been trained in madrasas under the tutelage of Saudi Arabian imams to train the Pakistani youth in becoming, and the Afghan youth in becoming, the most violent adherents of Islam, not standard Islam, but the most primitive and violent type. And so we had this huge army, and we managed to drive the Soviet Union out of Afghanistan. It was viewed as a great success by the Central Intelligence Agency. And they just continued afterwards. And they discovered, hey, this is great. We can mobilize terror armies all over. And we mobilized terrorists in Libya. That's how we overcame and defeated and destroyed all of the civilization of Libya. It was actually the most profitable and the most successful nation in all of Africa. Very, very wealthy, highly educated, best of everything. People were very happy, and we demonized them, and then we went in, we bombed them. It was the French who carried out the murder of Colonel Gaddafi, who was an enormously popular figure in Libya. And that was by using Al-Qaeda in Libya. It was called the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. But we armed them, we organized them, we gave them their plans, and we overthrew the country. Then we took all of the looted weapons from Libya. They had an enormous arsenal, and we shipped them from Libya over to Turkey, where the Central Intelligence Agency conducted this operation called Timber Sycamore. It was very highly classified, but later it was disclosed. And we had this system of very major warehouses all near the Syrian border. And we supplied Al-Qaeda and to some extent ISIS with all of the weapons to create this vast terror army. And the irony of it is that 10 years earlier, 2001, there were 13 mostly Saudi Arabian people who flew 4 suicide jets and flew them into the Twin Towers and the Pentagon, killed 3,000 Americans. And we declared the war on terror. And we said we were going to chase these people to the ends of the earth. And then we never attacked Saudi Arabia, which had, they had been the ones who set up the attacks. I'm not sure exactly who all was involved, but the Saudi Arabian government was involved. I suspect that at some very high level, the U.S. government was involved in the 9/11 attacks on the Twin Towers and Pentagon. So this happens in 2001. Just 10 years later, okay, here's the biggest mass killing in American history here on our soil, you know, 3,000 people. 10 years later, the United States, through the same Central Intelligence Agency, becomes the unwavering supporters of Al-Qaeda in Syria. Same group that attacked us. And now here we are. And to this day, from 2011 to right now, the United States has been the unwavering supporter of Al-Qaeda in Syria. And we still supply, we arm, we give information to the Al-Qaeda group that is in Idlib province of Syria. Now, the Syrian army, the Syrian people rose up and defeated them across Syria. But then the United States jumped in and invaded Syria and seize the northern part of Syria, where we still have troops to this day. And we set up a little rump state under the Kurds. We said, well, the Kurds, they deserve to have their own country. Well, they're a minority in this little bit of Syria. So it's basically, we said, well, they ought to be able to dominate the Muslims and the Christians who live there. Well, that's kind of silly. Nobody has been saying, well, the Palestinians deserve their own state in Gaza, because the Gaza Strip has 1% Christians, 99% Muslims, and there are no Jewish people at all, none in the Gaza Strip. Why, if we think that people should be able to have their own state because they're a certain race or ethnic group or religious group, then why shouldn't the Gaza people have their own state? Why should they be dominated by some other country? So we tend to be very inconsistent about these things. It's just interesting to see the way that foreign policy works.
We had Mahmoud Abbas in Russia talking with Putin, and later on, and before that, we had China trying to manage the situation in Gaza between these Palestinian groups. But Russia, China, we know what they're thinking of the conflict in Gaza. When it comes to the United States, even with these two assassinations of Hamas leaders, political and military leaders of Hamas, who were supposed to negotiate with Israel on the issue in Gaza, but Israel decided to assassinate them. And do you understand what the United States is planning to do? Because at the end of the day, it doesn't seem that they don't have any sort of plan, just going after Netanyahu and his policies and his mindset, his party, to do whatever they want, but go and conditional support going to Netanyahu and Israel to whatever they're doing and whatever they have been doing in Gaza. Other than that, you don't see, just talking, Anthony Blinken was talking recently, just last week, he was talking about let's put these differences aside. Let's talk with Iran. Let's go after some sort of negotiations in Gaza. But the outcome is nothing. They're not doing anything in that direction, just supporting Israel. That's the ultimate policy in the United States. It seems to us as observers, who the people who are witnessing what's going on. What's your understanding on the official policy, what they're trying to do? Because they cannot stay there forever helping Israel. There has to be some sort of solution for that.
This is this is one of the very interesting areas of policy, foreign policy. And it's fairly straightforward. Benjamin Netanyahu desperately wants the United States to be in the war, in his war, fighting against Hezbollah, which is the Lebanese army, or against Iran. Well, actually, against both of them. Netanyahu wants us to be fighting Hezbollah in Lebanon and the Iranian government and other places if he could get it. He'd like to have us sending people in and fighting actively against Syria or Iraq or wherever he could do. It's important to him because he is sort of under indictment. He's awaiting criminal trial on some pretty serious charges, but he can't be prosecuted while he remains in office. Now, he has a lot of opposition in Israel, and once the fighting dies down, then it's very likely that people will say, "Hey, we got to get this guy out of office." Once he's out of office, he is likely to be prosecuted, and his, from what I know about it, he's at significant risk of being found guilty and being sent to prison. So he gains a great deal by keeping the war going. What he has done is he is trying to do things that are so provocative that the Iranians or the Lebanese, the Hezbollah people, are forced to respond. And once they respond, then the United States is in the war because the way American politics works is the top supporters of Israel and its policies are also the very top donors to the Democratic Party and very large donors to the Republican Party also. So to a certain extent, they have the United States checkmated, where Benjamin Netanyahu knows that he can do anything he wants, no matter how provocative. I mean, he could send a fleet of bombers out, and at some time where there's a big children's parade in Tehran, he could bomb them. And then immediately come back and say, "Oh, we're expecting an attack by the Iranians. The Iranians are coming to get us." And the American leadership will say, "Okay, we're going to back you." So we're always in the U.S. media, we're always saying, "Oh, look at this. The Iranians are so aggressive and so forceful." Well, they've really been very, very moderate because things have been done to them that normally countries would respond with military force. And they've arranged things where they, when Israel bombed the Iranian consulate, which is sacred territory under international law. But they deliberately bombed it because they thought it would draw Iran into the war, and that would draw the United States. And so they murdered Iranians in the consulate. And then immediately all the news media started screaming, saying, look at this, Iran is so aggressive. It looks like they may attack Israel. And nobody was saying, well, they might attack Israel because Israel committed this diplomatic outrage. They didn't say that. That's not the way that the media works in the United States. It's always one-sided. It's like, well, all of a sudden these madmen are angry at Israel. But it didn't work. And actually, the Biden administration worked together with Iran to where the Iranian government could send some drones to attack Israel, and the drones hit somewhere that was unimportant, and the drones that they sent were very slow moving, and Iran let us know when they were being fired, and the United States went in, shot down most of them. The Israelis shot some down. The Jordanians, perhaps Saudis, I'm not sure, but there's sort of a coalition. It was one of these, dark of night type of operations where everybody got together and kept the thing from escalating. It was a disappointment to Netanyahu. He was hoping that Iran would attack and kill a lot of people in Israel, and they didn't. And it was just very frustrating to him. So then he turns around and he carries out this attack of the top official from Hamas who was in Iran. And now this was the top peace negotiator for Hamas. This wasn't some soldier who was out there trying to get Iran to give arms and supplies. This was a guy who was negotiating for the release of hostages and for the armed forces to stop killing people so that people could live again. And so again, you have Netanyahu selecting the most provocative, outrageous type of person to murder, and it was carried out, and the Israelis successfully executed this fellow who was the peacemaker. He was the man who was going to try to give Israel back its hostages and hope to get something for the Hamas side, but they killed him. And I think Netanyahu is saying, okay, now we've got it. Now the Iranians, and there's no way they can just sit back and not do anything. So they're going to have to attack Israel, and then I'll get the United States in. And in fact, of course, in the United States, when you listen to the media, it was all one-sided. They talked about the assassination of the Hamas leader. They didn't say that he was the top negotiator for peace. You could read that in the press, but you couldn't see it on television. It was just, hey, top Hamas guy. And Americans, they think, okay, Hamas is bad, so yeah, kill them all. So they never connect the dots for people to say, well, look how outrageous this is. This is somebody in the midst of negotiations between Israel and Hamas to try to settle things in Gaza. You killed the top negotiator on the other side. Well, it's an outrage. But the American people don't understand that. All they see is somehow Iran, for some reason, is all upset about things, and they're going to attack this poor victim state of Israel. And my goodness, why would they do that? They must be insane people. Well, they're not insane. They're acting rationally, but a little too rationally for Netanyahu, because they didn't attack. Now, the same thing goes for Hezbollah in Lebanon. The Israelis have been carrying out murders of people, very high officials for Hezbollah, and hoping that Hezbollah will then respond with some massive attack. And Hezbollah has been very, very disciplined about it, and they're not going to be drawn into things. Now, in the meantime, back in the United States, Biden, the last thing in the world that, well, Biden is, he's probably not running, but he may be. Biden and Kamala Harris are trying desperately not to get the United States in this before the November elections. So they dispatched a fleet of American warships, but it's not as big as it might be, and it's probably not sufficient to have a big impact if war were to break out. But they can't just do nothing, because the Israel lobby is so dominant. It is much more powerful than the president of the United States on this area, not on everything. I mean, the president has a lot of impact on environmental policies and, you know, different domestic things. But when it comes to foreign policy, the Israel lobby is considerably more powerful than the president of the United States. And it's hard to understand. It doesn't mean that the Israel lobby is more powerful than the president in all respects. It just means when it comes to foreign policy that somehow affects Israel, Israel is dominant over the United States.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Senator, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
It was great to talk to you, and we'll see how things unfold.
Yeah. See you soon. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.